we're reviewing the end of the semester, so we're reviewing our classes on the Jewish home. Okay, so we'll just quickly touch on many points that we discussed during the course of the year. We mentioned the story of Hillel and the beggar who came to the door while Hillel was with an important guest outside, and his wife felt comfortable giving the beggar the food that he needed. And from there we discussed the concept that pressure is harmful to the home. The only reason Hillel's wife could do what was correct was because there was no pressure, so she felt comfortable doing what was right and giving the beggar the food that he needed, and then preparing a whole new meal for Hillel and his guest while they waited. We discussed the Gemara that says that a person who applies pressure, religious pressure in the home, is ensuring that the home will transgress mitzvot, because the time will come, a Friday afternoon, when the wife did not get to light the Shabbos candles on time, and then she'll light them after sunset, which is biblically prohibited for fear that her husband come home and find them out, or she won't be able to find the hechsher kosher meat that her husband likes, so she might end up buying non-kosher meat just so that she has what her husband likes. So we said that usually Chazal teach us that religious pressure is counterproductive in a home, and Chazal discourage religious pressure in the home. We went on to discuss the importance of building together, understanding one another, and not being judgmental. We each have to have space to grow our own way. We discussed the importance of greeting our spouse warmly. The story of Rav Shlomo Zalman and how he prepared himself before he came home. We discussed Beis Shammai and the importance of greeting someone warmly with a smile. Shammai Omer. We discuss speech. That for women, speech is representative of connection, and for men, speech is a tool. Women will want longer conversations. Men want things that, what's the point? We gave that funny example of a conversation which goes round, 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 and the husband can't figure out what the point is. There's one point about speech that I didn't get to mention. I will add it now. Sometimes husbands find themselves frustrated. They feel they cannot share with their wives what's going on in their lives. And the wives are frustrated because they feel like their husbands are not sharing with them what's going on in their lives. He gets on the phone with his mother and he shares with her that he got a raise today. He's been home with me for 2 hours and he didn't think it right to mention. So husbands will often tell their wives that I tried sharing with you what's going on, but you weren't interested. And the wife says, what do you mean I wasn't interested? And the husband says, well, I started and then he went off on a tangent. So women, that's their style of speech. Very often women will, they're talking about one thing and her friend will mention something totally different, but that's connected slightly, and then she'll go on another tangent, they go on and on and on, and then the one who wanted to share something with her friend will say, and back to the point at hand, and bring the whole conversation back. For men, if I'm telling you something, being that our conversations are very focused and goal-oriented, so if you went off tangent, you obviously are not interested in the goal I'm trying to get to. And it's beneath our dignity to bring a conversation back to the point at hand. It's something that men don't do. And very often, that this causes a big misunderstanding between men and women. That the man will say, I can't talk to her. I can't share with her what's going on in my life because she's not interested. And she'll say, of course I'm interested. What do you mean? And he'll say, well, you always interrupt and you always go off on tangents. And she'll say, what do you mean interrupt? Are you giving me a lecture or we're having a conversation? So, we're having a conversation, but if you want me to tell you what's going on in my life, you have to let me tell you. It's two different conversational styles. By women, if you're interested in what I have to say, you're an active participant. Part of which it means you're taking the conversation off on tangents. I was once interviewing a girl for shidduchim by phone. This is the way I do it. And after she's talking for like 2 minutes, she says, "Hello?" I say, "Yes." She says, "Are you there?" I say, "Yes." She says, "Then why don't you give signs of life?" So I said, "Because I'm listening and I'm taking notes." But her question was a classical female question, because by women, if you're listening, then you say things as you're listening. "Yeah, yeah, I had something just like that too." By men, if you're listening, you're silent. So when she says, "Yeah, yeah, I had something just like that too," the man, who is polite, will turn silent, because he's being polite, he's listening. So she'll go on and on. Well, it happened that, and then she's going on and on and on, because she assumes, well, he wants to hear, so I'll tell him. She didn't necessarily mean to take the conversation on the tangent. She's playing the role of a good listener in female circles. For him, well, she obviously wants to tell me more than she wants to hear what I have to say, so I'll hear what she has to say. And so many men find themselves in relationships where they're doing a heck of a lot of listening and very little talking, because anytime they try to talk, she wants to show she's interested, so she starts a tangent. And then he's not going to bring it back. So that's a misunderstanding. And the sooner that couples understand this and share with one another this difference in conversational styles, the sooner they can adapt to one another. And once the wife understands this, so she'll do the role of saying, "Wait a second, you were in the middle of telling me about what happened today at work. Could you get back to that?" Once she understands what's going on. Yeah, Yehuda?
If you try to tell a woman something and she goes up on a tangent, you know, all the time, is she going to still think that you don't share things with her?
Yes, 100%.
So how do you...
You share with her this difference, and you tell her, you point out to her this difference. When she's going off on a tangent, she doesn't mean to go off on a tangent. She's being an active participant in the conversation. Women will very often be frustrated with men because they're not active participants in a conversation. And he'll say, "What do you want? I'm listening politely. You want me to interrupt you all the time?" It's a classical difference, but it's a classical difference that people miss. And then it causes huge misunderstandings between them.
So the only way to overcome any problems in this area is to point out what she's doing. She understands she's not allowing you to share what you have to say.
Well, if you point it out in a good-natured way, then it's something that the couple can work on. Either he will work on not being frustrated when she goes off on tangents, and he'll get back to the point, or she'll work on not taking things off on tangents, or both. What frustrates men is that very often they'll say, "But when I talk to my mother, it's not like that." Well, I'm sure it's not like that. Because when you talk to your mother, she's not looking to be an active participant. All she wants to hear is what's going on in your life. When you'll have kids, you'll see that your wife will be the same way. To your kids, she'll be very focused and listening to everything they have to say. But when it's a conversation with her spouse, suddenly she's got her 20 cents, not her 2 cents, her 20 cents to put in. And that's because you're partners, so she has a lot to say. It's not like a child where all she wants is to hear what's going on in his life, and she's thinking 10 times, "Should I say something?" Or he'll think, "I'm babying him. Should I say something?" Or he'll say, "I'm interfering." With a child, the parent, the mother thinks that. With the spouse, hopefully she doesn't think that. She's free.
Should you bring up this kind of misunderstanding before we reach the point where she's kind of frustrated that you're not sharing, or should it just happen when he needs that?
Either way is fine. You know, if you have good notes from this class, then it's not a bad idea to review them with her. See what you agree with and what you disagree with. You might not agree with everything I say. She might not agree with everything I say. Who says I'm right in everything I say? I don't say I'm right. This is what I think today. We'll see what I think tomorrow. So it's a good thing for a couple to take a book on marriage and learn it together. And then off of the book, they can discuss their differences. You don't even have to agree with everything the book says. It's just a good starting point. One of the challenges that couples have is familial relationships, dealing with in-laws, dealing with siblings. This is an area where, if possible, spouses should stay out of one another's hair. We don't understand our spouse's relationship with their parent, with their siblings. It's not our business to interfere and tell them what's right. There can be times where we make decisions together. You know, if your brother is having a simcha, what's right is that we'll be there. If your parents feel this way, even though we disagree, maybe we shouldn't say something. But that's in a way where we're thinking about it together. But we don't have to understand and define something which predates our relationship. You know, their relationship is their relationship, and we should respect it and stay out of it unless there's something that really requires our saying something. Yeah, Jonathan.
No question. Let's say I get married, and Miss Roshan, and the thing is, I'm not saying it because I've got trouble with my mom, but sometimes a mother-in-law can be a pain. How do one deal with this? Because I know from what I've heard, it's always something like the mother-in-law, the mother-in-law. How does one cope with the mother-in-law?
So sometimes it's good to limit contact with the mother-in-law. I've recommended to many a chatan that they call their mother from work or from yeshiva. That way the wife doesn't have to feel competition, and the wife doesn't have to be there, and the wife doesn't have to have the conversations with the mother-in-law. And we once had a chatan who was an orphan. He didn't have a father. So his mother was living alone, and she wanted to hear from him every day, which is legitimate. But the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law had issues. So he asked me, he said, you know, I married my wife, but that doesn't mean I'm just going to forsake my mother. She is a widow living all alone. I owe it to her to call her. So I said, fine, you know, they're not contradictory. Just call her from a payphone. Get yourself calling cards and call from somewhere else. You don't have to call from home.
And also, how do one deal like me, who's a convert in the end? And it's a big thing, because how will I deal with my mom? Because it's a big thing, because she's not Jewish, and I'm Jewish, and same as she. Just say, she comes here, and how do one deal with it?
So we usually try to limit the contact, because it can be very harmful to the children also. Not only to the children, to the parents also. You know how many times guys here have a visit from their parents after they convert, and then it shakes their whole life. It puts into question everything they've been doing until now. And we've had many times that guys didn't manage to get out of it. And we're holding before the break. Some of you are flying back to your parents. You should know that that also has that impact. Very often, people, when they come in contact with the old scenarios they came from, that can shake their whole world. Where one can limit it, one should. Where one can get adoptive families and new contacts, one should try to develop that. It's also harmful to the children, because even if we take the best case scenario, let's say your parents are very respectful of what you're doing and supportive, and they're all for it. At the end of the day, if your child grows up and he knows, well, I have the grandparents out in Uzbekistan who eat pork and keep Christmas, and then I have my parents who keep kosher and keep Hanukkah. What happens in the child's mind is that as he grows up, he knows there are two legitimate options. And whether you realize it or don't, whether you say it or don't, in his mind, there's always the option, well, I could always take the easier route and be like my grandparents. So I'm not succeeding in school here in Israel, but they love me. So I'm not keeping mitzvot well here, but they love me and they're not so demanding of me. And that's a best case scenario. We won't discuss worst case scenarios. So that's why it's advisable for the balance of your children to try and limit that contact. And try and get your parents to conform to what you're doing here. So if you can ask them politely to wear a yarmulke when they visit your home, that's good. And if you could ask them when they're at your home not to be Michal Shabbos overtly. So if they want to drive the car, they should park it 3 blocks away. They should leave the cell phones in the car. Not, you don't have to demand them. You know, they're not Jewish. So if they don't keep Shabbat, and they have no reason they should. But if they want to visit your home, there's a minimal level which if you can ask them to keep, if they could be respectful of that, then it's better for your children. It's not always possible, so that's where it's helpful to consult with the rabbi to know which points to stand your ground and which points to give in on. Not every point is critical, but that takes experience. If you can find new people who fill in those shoes, that's in your best interest, then you get the best of both worlds. And many, many olim do that. They find new adoptive families. But it's not easy. It's a challenge. It's a challenge of Aliyah. It's a challenge of the tshuva process. It's a challenge of the gear process. And the person shouldn't overestimate himself. We once had a student here who was doing great, top student. And then a relative came to visit him, and they wanted him to take them to a tour of one of the ancient cities in Israel. So he took them on a tour, and then, of course, there were ancient synagogues and ancient churches. So they went into the churches. And they respected that he was outside. But he took him at least a year to settle down from that experience. You know, just standing there, and then the priest came out, and the priest did the worst thing he could have done to him. The priest was so nice and respectful and sweet and kind. So the guy left there, and the priest said to his grandparent, "You have to respect your children. They've chosen their own path. They're leading moral lives." He spoke so positively that the guy left there thinking to himself, And I'm telling you, it took him at least a year to get back to himself. One visit, one trip. So we can't know what's going to affect us and how it's going to affect us. It's not easy. It's one of the challenges that don't end, but you could do your kids a favor and try to limit that challenge for them. We discussed the importance of balance and recognizing that the home and the wife are number one. Meaning the wife has to feel, and we have to feel, that she is our first priority. Sometimes people get carried away with mitzvot at the expense of the home. So a person wants to run an open home and have guests, and his wife is up till 2-3 in the morning, and she's got zero koach left, but we got to have guests. It's a big mitzvah. And who said that's right? Sometimes it is right, and sometimes it's not right. And people have to work together, and when we have shared ideals, so we have to hear what our wives are saying and what they're not saying. And our job is to take care of them, and that's a big mitzvah too. We discussed that one of the perspectives that a person should have is that his wife's gashmias, his wife's physical needs, are his spiritual needs. When you give her a physical gift, when you give her a new dress or something else, you're doing a mitzvah. You don't have to think about the fact that she's getting something physical. You have to think about, I'm doing something spiritual. Anything physical you do on behalf of your wife is really something spiritual, which you're doing if you do it correctly. We discussed the importance of honoring one's wife. The halacha says now that Yom Tovim are coming up, one is supposed to buy his wife a new garment or new jewelry, and mechabdo yoser migufo. The halacha expects of the husband to honor his wife more than himself. So if there's a limited budget and they both are in equal need of a new suit, and only one of them is going to get it because we have a limited budget, the halacha says she gets it. Mechabdo, he's supposed to honor her yoser migufo, more than himself. And of course, that's maybe it's needless to say that we don't make jokes at their expenses. And it's something which people sometimes take lightly, because women in their good-natured form will very often smile or laugh, and they won't say how much they're hurt by a comment that's made at their expense. And Chazal told us that women are hurt far more deeply than men. Chazal say, "Mitoch shedimata mitzuya onata kerova," being that she tears more easily, that's indicative of the fact that she feels more deeply, and that one can transgress the biblical prohibition of "Lo tonu ishet amito," do not afflict your fellow man more easily with one spouse, because wives feel more deeply. And we said that's an important perspective, that we don't view them as crybabies, but rather we say what we would feel in order to cry, it would take us, let's say, on a scale of 1 to 10, it would take us a 10 to be brought to tears. When we do something that's a 2 on a scale of 1 to 10, when we do something that's a 2, they feel it like we would feel a 10. And we said one of the ways to imagine that is like a hearing aid, that if you turn up the hearing aid, so that's how they hear what we're saying. We gave the example, a husband is with his wife, she's trying on a garment, and she says, "How does it fit?" And he says, "Well, maybe it's a little tight." And she bursts into tears and says, "My husband just said I'm the fattest woman in the world." He didn't say that, but that's what she heard. Now, there's one point here which I don't remember if we mentioned. There's an interesting, I don't know what to call it even, an interesting tendency, maybe we should call it, an interesting combination. That on the one hand, what you say, anything that's even slightly derogatory, is heard 10 notches higher than it was said. On the other hand, anything they say, they mean, very often, they say it 10 notches louder than they mean. So what does that mean? If a husband and a wife are sitting at home, and the wife says something to one of the kids, and the husband says to her, "Maybe you shouldn't tell him that." So she could turn to him and say, "You always undermine everything I do." Always? Everything? He looks at like, whoa, wait a second. Always? Everything? So women, just like they feel larger than was said by us, they say louder than they feel themselves. Very often women will use terms and the husband is stunned by this. And this is a point that I forgot to mention during the year. And it's a very, very important point, because it's one of the major peeves that husbands have when they're newly married. Husbands will very often come back to me and say, "Never in my life would I ever speak to someone the way she speaks to me. Never. Never. I can't believe it." And this is one of the keys. That's why a woman will sometimes tell a man, "I hate you." And the man is like, "What? I don't understand." Now, if he were to say, "You're getting on my nerves," she'd come back and say, "You said you hate me, that I'm the worst person in the world." And he's like, "I didn't say that, I don't understand." So you see this interesting combination? You say something small, she hears it big. She says something big, she means it's small. You see that? So a guy will sometimes say, "But that's a contradiction, I don't understand." But if you think about it, it stems from the same place. Her words are expressing what she feels. It's not what she thinks. Does she really hate you? She doesn't really hate you. But right now, she's overtaken with that emotion. So that's the emotion that's coming out. When you say something, so she hears it much louder. We discussed the importance of compliments. Yes?
How do we know when she's actually being like, how do we know when she's being, when she's not exaggerating her words? Is there such a thing?
If she says she hates you, she's exaggerating.
Okay, it's not such an obvious line. Is it?
Nope.
No? So if it sounds dramatic, it is.
Well, I always say, it's like someone once said, a girl. We had a couple over a few weeks ago, and the wife said the following line. She said, "Girls use numbers to express a concept." We were discussing a story. A young chatan went to the apartment which they were going to rent to clean it out. This was before they were married. And the kala tells him, in the drawer in the kitchen there are a million ants. So he comes and he's looking through their apartment, and he's looking, and he finds one drawer with two ants. And he calls up his future mother-in-law, and he asks if the kala is there, and she says, no, she's resting now. So he says, well, look, I'm in the apartment now. I won't be able to come back for a few days. She asked me to take care of the ants before she comes. Do you know which drawer she found the ants in? So the future mother-in-law says, well, I think it was this and this drawer. So he says, no, I checked that drawer. There are only two ants there. So she says, yeah, and? So he says, no, she said there were a million ants in the drawer. So she said, no, she meant that drawer. She was right, the mother-in-law. The Chatan, he hears a million, he figures. 30, 50, 100. Not two. Right? So, when I mentioned this story at the Shabbos table, so the Kalo, the very young couple, the Kalo said, why was he surprised? To women, numbers are representative of how we feel. It has nothing to do with the number that's there. So this is in general, it's so. Meaning a woman feels a certain way, so she uses harsh terms to express how she feels. You hear her using harsh terms, so don't take it the way men speak. She said this, so it means exactly that. No, it means that she feels very, very strongly about this. I'm not saying to disregard what she's saying, quite the contrary. Give it the weight. Just don't take it in literal terms the way men would. We discussed that compliments connect and criticism divides. And it doesn't matter how correct you are. Very often the husband says, what does she want from my life? I just told her the truth. Well, the truth is that us husbands also would be insulted. The way one husband once put it, he said, her criticism is hurtful. And if she criticizes anyways, then what she's telling me is that this point that she's criticizing me on is more important than whether it hurts me or not. Go ask her if that's what she felt. It's not. It goes both ways. Obviously, women hear things louder. Women are more sensitive. But men are sensitive too. And criticism divides. And it doesn't matter how right you are. You have to think 10 times. Is it worth hurting my spouse or not? The more practice you'll get at marriage, the less you'll say. By the same token, compliments are the glue of marriage. But true compliments, true appreciation. A good husband knows how to express in 10 different ways his appreciation for a good breakfast. And so on and so forth. That's a small example. One of the ways in which a person can help their spouse evolve in the direction they like is by strengthening the positive. If you compliment what's good, then that encourages the other person to do it. And that's the way we all would like to grow. A guy comes home and the house is all neat. So if he's going to compliment, it's so amazing how you cleaned up the house and everything's neat and fresh and clean, he's probably going to find his wife saying, it was nothing. What's she telling him? Say it more. Argue with me. Tell me how much, what a good job I did. Well, men are the same way very often. The wife will tell her husband a compliment and he's going to say, it was nothing. What does he really mean? He doesn't even know it. He also means that. Don't agree with me. What often happens? Often, he'll compliment. She'll say, it was nothing. I did a much better job last time. I'll try a second time. I'll try a third time. At some point, one night, he's going to say, forget it. What am I going to argue with her for? That's a mistake. Just understand to read what she's saying. We have to know that happiness is our responsibility. Don't think that she's going to be the source of happiness in the home. You be the source of happiness in the home. You be the source of holiness in the home. And more often than not, your wife is going to be a reflection of you. Very often people have expectations from their spouse. Don't have expectations. Have expectations from yourself. Have expectations what to give, not what to receive. Marriage is about giving. Marriage is about working. Marriage is the most beautiful thing when approached correctly. Correctly means I think about what do I owe? What am I supposed to give? I do not think what am I supposed to receive. The day a person starts thinking, well, I deserve and it's not fair and, that's the day the happiness ends in the marriage. The second, our perspective is about what am I entitled to? That's the second of marriage is doomed. We discussed the story about the couple that separated and decided to reconnect for a trial period. And the rabbi told them, don't bother. So they said, what do you mean? He said, no marriage can stand a trial period. If it's a trial, it won't work. Marriage can only work if we enter it with both feet. You jump off the diving board with 2 feet. If you jump off with 1 foot, you get hurt and you don't get a good dive. The only way it can work is if you jump in with both feet. If a person gets married and says, this is going to work, and this is my Eishes Chayil, and this is what Hashem wants for me, then it could work. If a person is in marriage for a trial run, no trial run on marriage can work. Because by its mere nature, marriage is trying and aggravating, and if a person is going to keep a scorecard, is it worth it or not? Well, then on the scorecard, it's not going to be worth it. Any day you could end up your day with 100 grievances, not 10. 100 reasons why this doesn't make sense. But if you don't keep a scorecard and you roll with the punches, then you'll see the big picture, and you'll see that the big picture really does make sense. It's the greatest gift God gave man, quite possibly. We find that the Torah and many other things of value are compared to a good wife, because marriage is really one of the most precious things that God gave humanity. But it has to be built, it has to be cultivated, it has to be worked on. We discussed that enemy number one of marriage is the thought, maybe she wasn't Mrs. Right. No marriage could stand up to that. And somehow people become very, very frum when it comes to this. This is one of those phone calls I get a few times a year. I'd say once a month, but people can't reach me anymore by phone, so now it's down to once every 2-3 months. Rabbi, how do I know if she was right? She was right. How do you know? Do you have Ruach HaKodesh? Yeah, I have Ruach HaKodesh. She was right. How do you know? I'm telling you, she was right. You got to approach it with that attitude. You have to approach it with that attitude. There's no other way marriage can work. And the first challenge that couples have is that they start questioning this point. They start saying, wait a second, I didn't know I was getting into this. I didn't know she snores. I didn't know she squeezes the toothpaste from the middle. And I'm giving you bad examples. There are real examples. I didn't know he puts the floss next to the bed. I didn't know he eats apples and puts them next to the computer. I didn't know he takes off his socks and dumps them next to the bed. I didn't know he showers whenever there's a new chasman kala in town. He thinks showers is just for that. I didn't know that. All these are small examples. In marriage, there are real examples, and real challenges. And very often, I'll meet with a chasan after a few months, and they'll say, we got to talk. And I'll say, I'll tell you, don't tell me. So he says, you can't know. I say, let's try. And he says, okay. And I say, she's worse than a witch. Witches are nice next to her. And he looks at me and says, you knew? Why didn't you tell me? And the answer is that it's very normal in the beginning that that couples feel that way. In the beginning, when we're suddenly faced with living in close proximities with someone else, so it's challenging, it's difficult. And what we notice is the imperfections, the things that someone else has to work on. And we have to know that marriage is about loving someone else where they do not love themselves. Every one of us knows what our imperfections are. And we don't need someone else to show it to us. You want to destroy a marriage, pick up a mirror and tell your spouse what they're really worth. Pick up a mirror and tell your spouse what imperfections they have, where they're wrong, what they have to work on. They'll hate you. And rightfully so. You want to build a marriage, then show them that you love them where they don't love themselves. How many a wife turned to her husband and said, I'm fat, aren't I? I should be losing weight. And the husband says, well, I don't know if you're fat, but you could use losing a few pounds. And she goes off wailing to the bedroom, and he's like, what does she want from me? I didn't say she was fat. How many couple, the wife said, you know, I have no self-control. I shouldn't have eaten that whole tub of ice cream last night, but I was just sitting here, and you know, so I polished off a whole bar of chocolate, or a whole pack of a whole bars of chocolate. Why'd you bring it into the house? And he's like, wait a second. You asked me to buy it. What do you mean, why did I bring it into the house? Who asked you to finish off four packs of chocolate in one night? And then you tell me, you have to diet. Go do some exercise. Why don't you come? I'll sign you up. She knows. She knows it. She doesn't need him to tell it to her. But if he would indicate to her how much he loves her, and that's not why he married her, and that's not the main thing in life, then she might have the strength to sign up for weight fitness class, or whatever they call those things. There was once a church that had a gathering for women where they were supposed to work on their traits, so they'd meet every Sunday. And one Sunday, the agreement was that every woman would come home and ask her husband what she has to work on, what trait he thinks she has to work on most. And so every wife went home. And one wife comes home and she tells her husband, this is my homework, so what do you think I should work on? So her husband says, I have to think about it. So she's wondering what's going to be. He says, I'll tell you tomorrow. Fine. The next morning he leaves to work, and sometime in the mid-morning there's a knock on the door. She opens the door, and there's a bouquet of roses, and there's a note, I love you just the way you are. All the women came back to the group the next week very upset at their husbands, but one. Now, I ask you, did she really think she was perfect? And did the other women really want to know from their husbands what they had to work on? At the end of the day, we all know we have things to work on. And even if we have homework that requires us to ask that of our spouses, it's not really what we want to hear. We want to hear the positive. We want to hear that at least he loves me where I don't love myself. We went into a class about loneliness. I don't know if you guys remember this, the class about fortune telling. And that really there's a deep loneliness that every person senses. And that loneliness can be mollified within a marriage if we only allow our spouses in. And we discussed the introductions that should be given, that very often people have things that are deep down inside and they don't share with anyone because they're scared they'll be laughed at or looked down upon. And very often what happens when people try to share that with their spouses is just that. The spouse reacts exactly the way they shouldn't. Either they laugh or they say, what? I can't believe you're like that. If we prepare our spouses, and then hopefully they'll be mature enough, that we could share with them more about who we really are. This can take time. It doesn't necessarily happen in the beginning, but it's something we should aspire to. We should aspire to a type of relationship where we really do share who we are completely with one another. So far, you guys are with me? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes?
I have a question about what if a woman marries a different place? How does one go to...
In here, one marries?
If somebody marries a different place? Same a Jew, but a different...
Black and white?
Yeah, black and white. How do one deal with this?
If someone marries someone from a different race... So I think the major challenges are cultural, meaning practically there is no challenge. What's the big deal? Moshe Rabbeinu married someone of a different race. The challenges are that there are major cultural differences, and that's something which a person just has to figure out, how to understand one another and respect one another. It helps to talk to other people who did it, Even though generalizations are usually erroneous, but there are generalizations that have a lot of validity. You know, if you talk about Moroccan women loving to clean, so yeah, Moroccan women, you know, the overall majority of them, they do wash their floors 2 or 3 times a day. And that's not an exaggeration. If you talk about certain Moroccan women not allowing the husband into the kitchen, it's not an exaggeration. There are such Moroccan women, and they're not a small group. If you speak about Polish mothers, the things they say about Polish mothers are true. I'm a son of a Polish mother. And if you speak about German mothers, then believe me, what they say is true. I'm a grandson of a German mother. So the stereotypes, even though they're generalizations, they're not always accurate, but there is a lot to be said for them, and that's where it might be helpful for someone to consult with someone else who has done it. Obviously, if you're white and you're going to marry someone who's black, no, then you should speak to another man who's white who married someone black, not a man who's black married someone white.
Okay, but where does the children fit in? This is the thing, because I've heard from some experience that some of people from what I've heard is that the children is very hard for them.
I don't know enough about that to answer. But you know, Rav Listman has a daughter who married someone from Ethiopia. You could see if they're amenable to talking about it. I don't know. Some people are sensitive about it. I don't know. We discuss spiritual growth and the patience for one another, and that there's a difference between before marriage and after marriage. After marriage, a couple should consult with the rabbi and figure out how to make it work in spite of the potential differences. These are some of the things we discussed. The rest of it is online. And, you guys are invited to visit TorahForMe.org. You have this year's series, last year's series, previous years. Some of the information is the same. And every year has its nuances and classes that are different. Next semester we'll have to decide if we're continuing the Jewish home or something else to be seen.